Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix. From AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
Hey, thanks for joining us. It is the ATS Mix Show, and that means, of course, that I must be Johnny Anonymous.
And I'm John Lear.
And it's such a pleasure to have you, John Lear, with us.
Is that 50 cents? Do I get 50 cents for that?
No, we have to pay John Lear 50 cents every time we say that.
I'm Dave Rabbit.
Well, thank you. We've got a great show for everybody tonight because we got a chance to interview the associate editor from www.ufodigest.com, our good friend, Robert Morningstar.
Yeah, boy, what a great guy he is, John. And, you know, you and I asked him a bunch of questions, and we asked him everything from just the generalized things that he normally talks about, but we also talked about his trip up to Washington, D.C. for the National Press Conference on UFOs, which I thought was extremely interesting. What did you like about his interview?
Well, I enjoyed the whole interview, obviously, but there's a little secret that he related to us, and only to us, he claims, that he will also be revealing to the world later on in January. So you'll have to keep your ears open for that little bit of secret that he shares with us, and that's going to be a lot of fun. So before we really go real south with this intro, we should really dive into the interview before we screw it up anymore.
Hey, that's what you get. When you get Dave and Johnny, you roll the dice.
Snake eyes.
ATS Mix.
Yeah, listen up.
From Above Top Secret.
Jesus Christ.
.com. Featured interview.
Hello, this machine takes messages for Robert Morningstar.
Well, that's good.
Hello?
Hello,
this machine
sir.
Takes messages for Robert Morningstar. That said, we don't really want to hear your message, so don't bother calling us.
Oh, I just screen all my calls.
I love screening all your calls.
Reminds me of somebody else that screens their calls.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a partner who screens his calls.
We have to.
Oh, you big baby.
I get a lot of offers from businesses, and, you know, I'm on lists of sorts that people call for brokers, stocks.
Well, so I got news for you. You're on Johnny's and my list, brother.
I take your call. I just have to hear that it's you or recognize your name.
The thing I like about you, Robert, is that you keep us in the loop, you know?
Well, I try to share good information. That's the only way to get to the truth and a clearer picture of what's going on.
Tell us what's going on that's really interesting right now that and I know you get all these things, these bits of information. Tell us what's really hot going on right now in the community.
Well, as far as the UFO community is concerned, I think we're in the midst of a paradigm shift. A real shift in consciousness has occurred over the last year. I would say that it started with the Chicago Tribune story about the O'Hare UFO incident.
Right.
Where people really started to take a serious interest in ufology, particularly because this thing was hanging around a major terminal at the busiest airport in the central United States. But then it picked up steam. You know, that gave impetus to the recent National Press Club UFO conference in Washington, which
right.
I attended.
And how was that?
That was fabulous. It was one of those you had to be there moments in UFO history. When I heard about it, I found out about it 2 weeks before it was announced publicly. And I said to myself, my God, you know, this is a historic moment because I saw the names on the guest list. So I said to myself, you know, if you're a serious ufologist, you've got to be down there.
Is this the first kind of its type, or has there been a UFO Congress before?
Well, you see, it was the quality of the people, the speakers, that distinguished this. There had been other press conferences down there the Disclosure Project and other things dealing with NASA hiding information about Mars and the Moon. But this, the guest list was incredible. It included Deputy Chief Staff of the Belgian Air Force, former Chief of the Iranian Air Force, Major from Peru, who
right.
flew a Soviet Sukhoi 22 to 63,000 feet chasing a UFO for 22 minutes.
Wow.
Firing at it. Nick Pope, Ray Baller, the airline pilot who saw the two huge UFOs over the English Channel earlier this year.
Right.
Experts from France. I mean, the highest quality people.
You know, sure.
You're talking generals and chief of staff of the Belgian Air Force. And they were all there, including the men from the Rendlesham Forest incident. You know that famous one in England?
Sure.
That land at the Rendlesham, in the Rendlesham Forest near a major, the biggest U.S. Air Force base in the world at the time. So the men who were there, two of them, James Peniston and Colonel Charles Holt, were there. And
right.
guess what? I'm about to hold a plaster cast of the impression this object made in the forest.
No kidding.
So you see these History Channel things saying
right.
that it's the lighthouse, that they mistook the lighthouse in the distance.
Sure.
The lighthouse doesn't make a round impression in that really hard, hard ground in wintry England that leaves like, I would say it was about almost 3 feet in 3 feet in diameter.
Sure. In fact, didn't they also say that they thought they were rabbit holes? I remember hearing one guy say, "Oh, they're rabbit holes."
Well, listen, rabbits go straight in. You know, this was
right.
a.
I can say something, but I'm not.
Yeah, Dave Rabbit. So this is for you, and this is it's apropos. I was sitting in the chair there, center aisle, right in
right.
front of the podium, and Colonel Charles Holt, who was in charge of the airbase there in the investigation, comes up and he tells his story. And all of a sudden, he reaches under the desk and he pulls out this thing, and it's this plaster cast of the landing pod impression, of which three were made, and they were very smart to disseminate them. They shared them. They gave them out
sure.
in case so that no event could come around to destroy all three in one place.
How big were they?
Three, I would say, about 2.5 feet to almost 3 feet. It had been worn. It had become oblong because over the many years, chips had fallen off and the edges had somewhat crumpled. But you could see that this was a perfectly round object.
Right.
Kind of like if you sectioned a sphere, that's what it was. And holding it was incredible, you know?
I bet.
I was just feeling the contour of it.
It's what did it feel like?
Whatever made this thing was an incredibly heavy, heavy instrument, heavy craft.
Right.
The other part of the story that stunned me was Jim Peniston coming public with the fact that he walked up to this object and that he touched it. They don't tell you that on the History Channel, and they don't tell you
did
this
he?
About the landing, the cast of the landing impression, or even discovery they try to make of that these men were really nervous and fatigued and they mistook a lighthouse that was flashing a rotating beacon in the forest. Well, that plaster cast, kind of like Bigfoot, you know?
Sure.
Bigfoot.
Did he happen to say what the craft felt like?
Yes, he did. He said it looked like black onyx and it felt like metal. He said that when he was in close proximity to it, the air, the atmosphere around it was electrified, and he could feel the electricity around his clothing and around his body. I would probably venture to say that it was probably a big dose of adrenaline adding to that, too.
Sure.
So this
right.
was very... Now, Ray Bolger, I'd like to talk about him. He's the airline pilot on the charter flights or commercial flights across the English Channel, who is flying over Jersey, the island Jersey, off the French coast. And he could see what he described as a huge UFO, two of them, in fact, that were about... the size of an aircraft carrier, probably much larger than that. I'm just being conservative. I would say size of an aircraft carrier is a very conservative estimate. And before the NPC conference as they were seated there. I went to greet each of the guests to thank them for appearing. And when I spoke to Ray, I informed him that I was a pilot as well for 20, I am a pilot for 30 years or so, and that I had had my own close encounters in the air. And that opened up, you know, a little window of comradeship.
And, right.
And he opened up an envelope which he had with radar photographs of the radar that the British government had given him, of the targets, his position, and that of the other aircraft in the vicinity. There was another aircraft, and the two UFOs registered on the radar. And it showed his track and the other aircraft track. And so that was a very impressive.
Okay, can I do a quick sidebar, Robert, with you while we're on pilots and all that stuff?
Sure.
You know, I mean, dating back to Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when they're in the room there and all the air traffic controllers are seeing all these things on these blips and whatever, and then they're asking the pilots, do you want to make a report? And then all of a sudden, you know, they go, nah, we don't want to make a report, you know, yada, yada, yada. But, I mean, don't you really believe that when it really gets down to eyewitnesses, that pilots themselves are going to be one of the very best witnesses for these type of scenarios?
Absolutely. Simply because that's their environment. And, you know, they come up with challenges to pilot perception every once in a while in the debunkers.
Right.
Skeptical group, they say, oh, pilots are the same as anybody else. Like that guy, James McGahey, who was on the Larry King Live.
Right.
So, saying, oh, no, pilots are just as prone to misperception as anyone else. Well, that's bunk.
I had another word for it, but, yeah, I totally agree with you. It's bunk because they're up there in the air. My God, they don't have near the atmospheric problems that you have with the other way.
They have to prove their eyesight every 6 months. Any airline pilot and any commercial air traffic pilot has to take a physical every 6 months that proves his eyesight is good. And if your eyesight doesn't come up to par, you can't fly an airliner, and you can't fly commercially.
All right, but all right, now here's a little supplemental question. I'm going to jump in, and then I'm going to let the Johninator take a turn. You know, with all the pilots that we have in the world, why do you think it's a matter, Robert, of people don't want to put their reputation on the line or their job in jeopardy by coming forth? I mean, to me, now this is me, Robert, I want your intake on thing. To me, the reason why more people that are pilots are not responding and not reporting things is because they're a fear of having their life, their family, or whatever in jeopardy because of what they've seen. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely so. That's proven. And that is intentional because of a program instituted in the early 50s to debunk UFOs and to discredit witnesses. And as the bureaucracy of UFO control became entrenched, repeatedly pilots who reported UFOs, whether in the civilian or the military sphere, were challenged to take psychological tests, lie detector tests, knowing full well that what these men had seen was really what these men had seen. You know what I mean? It wasn't a hallucination.
Sure.
There's some crazy string going on, a thread going on UFO updates now about pilot hallucinations. And some researcher says that all pilots will suffer spatial disorientation, and you might even hallucinate that you're outside sitting on the wing watching yourself fly the plane. He's talking about pilot out-of-body experiences. It is so ridiculous, but...
Wait.
A pilot having an OBE.
Yeah. Wait a minute.
The skeptic's view of...
Hang on. No, wait a minute now. You're talking to the choir here. Are these people saying that they're actually in the aircraft and they're having this experience?
Well, this is what this researcher says he chronicled, that pilots have had out-of-body experiences in the air, where they step out of themselves and see themselves flying the airplane. Because of the long hours and the endurance that is required, the mind wanders. That's what they said, the mind wanders. And the pilot can actually have an out-of-body experience and hallucinate himself sitting on the wing looking at himself fly the plane. Maybe because one guy had dozed off and had a dream, or maybe he did have an out-of-body experience. The thing that they try to use to debunk pilots' observations is, you know, three pilots in the Japanese airliner saw that huge UFO in Alaska around 1987 or something.
Yeah, right.
And it was bigger than two aircraft carriers. It was on radar ahead of them and behind them and followed them. And still, they were challenging the pilots and the co-pilots and the flight engineers' accounts.
And wasn't that hallucination actually seen again, like about an hour or so later, by another aircraft?
Yes, I think that was what was most recently revealed, that they weren't the only ones that saw it.
Then it's
a
not
dual hallucination.
Yeah, I mean, how can you have a hallucination that's seen by another person?
Well, they call that mass hallucination.
Ah. But you're in an aircraft, right?
You know, they all have convenient terms.
What explanation is that, Robert? They're in an aircraft. It's not like we're walking across the Mojave Desert, but you're up in an aircraft. How can you have a mass hallucination of different aircraft in the air? That makes no sense to me.
That's right. But what I'll say is you can have illusions. You know, as a pilot, I have to be honest with you, there are very strange atmospheric effects that occur when you're flying that you're not ever going to see from the ground. And I'll just describe one to you, which dates back to...
Is this PG?
Oh, it's PG, yeah. I was on an airliner flying into Oberlin, Ohio. I was going to teach at Oberlin College. At the time, I used to travel around and be a visiting professor of Tai Chi in the Eastern Asian Studies Department.
Right.
At Oberlin. So we're coming down into Cleveland, and it's a wintry winter day, and it has just snowed, and there's a low-lying fog as we're coming in. And as we come into Cleveland, I look out the window, and this ball of light starts to track the airplane. A sphere of light is flying right alongside the airplane. We're descending from about 1,000 feet through 700 feet, and we're coming down, and this ball of light is pacing the airplane. And I'm mind-boggled, you know, because it is a solid sphere of light. And all of a sudden, I got a grip on myself and said, look, it's there, obviously. Now explain it to yourself. So I looked at the shadows of the trees and on the ground, which could be seen through the haze. And I saw that the angle of the sun was opposite me, and the angle of the sun was such, this was an early morning sun, that if the sun was hitting the snow, and the snow was reflecting the sunlight into the haze, and the haze was acting as a lens which coagulated an illusion of a ball of light traveling with the airplane right to just before the landing. The effect lasted till we were about, I would say, 150 feet above the ground.
Then the sun.
So you do see a lot of strange things, including meteors, meteorites, meteors when they're coming in, and illusions of atmospheric in nature for the most part, but they can be confused. I remember flying out of Dallas on an airliner wearing my Ray-Bans December 22nd, it was the JFK anniversary, November 22nd, 1998, totally overcast sky over Dallas. We climb out, break out through the clouds, and I look out the window, and I saw a ringed rainbow. But it was iridescent. It was very unusual. I wonder where that light's coming from. I looked up, and there was a full moon shining on the cloud tops and creating a rainbow ring of moonlight. So I'm telling you, there are a lot of strange things you see in the air, and they can be mistaken. But pilots are serious people, and when they report something, you know that they've taken their career in hand and... their courage, and they feel it's important enough to bring it out.
Sure.
I think it's changing. I personally don't report anything to anybody, you know, FAA, the police, the only way I would report a UFO incident if I saw someone abducted or someone injured, because it's like talking to a wall, you know?
The
mindset at the desk is instantly skeptical, ready to ridicule, ready to challenge you, ready to send the shrink to talk to you. So,
well, what else at the conference kind of blew you away?
Well, I have to tell you, the two accounts by the pilots, General Parviz Jafari very famous one. I'm sure all of you know about the F-4 incident, September 19th, 1976.
Right.
Over Tehran. A UFO was spotted, and they vectored an interceptor, one of our Phantom II jets, to get at it. And the thing climbed up to 25,000 feet, and it homed in on this thing that was would look like a star, but much brighter than a star. And all of a sudden, now these are details that they don't give you on the History Channel or Discovery Channel. The pilot says, all of a sudden, approached it. Two other lights broke out of it. And as those two lights raced at him, he veered. He also turned down his weapons and locked on to one of them. As soon as he locked on, his electronic equipment, his gyros, nothing worked. His radios went, and he broke off the attack. Then he saw the UFOs go back, merge with the original one, and then he saw the original one descend and land. And he went and he descended from 25,000 to 15,000 feet, circled the area, and he said he could see the UFO was so brilliant that it illuminated the sands all around.
Wow.
Now, there's an interesting twist to this story. You know that I study the whole history of ufology and abductions, and in particular.
Right.
Very interested in the field, so I study that far and wide around the world. And it turned out that on September 17th to the 19th in Tehran, outside Tehran, there are these mountains called the Erbuz Mountains to the northwest. And that night, two men were camping on a pilgrimage on a mountain there, on a cabin. One was a British doctor and one was an Iranian, a friend of his. They had an abduction experience, totally telepathic. They were confronted by, let's just call them men in black. They were in black from head to foot with hoods, and you could only see their eyes, and their eyes were kind of almond-shaped and wrapped around their eyes. That's what these men said. Then they were walked out without a word, walked out into the woods. They were walking on a carpet, and suddenly they were on a craft. And they were taken off with this craft in a gigantic bay window, you might say, where they could see everything below them. And they were flown all around Europe, and the whole night, or it seemed to them quite a few hours, where they saw these marvelous. Then they were brought back, and the fellows woke up lying on a road like Travis Walton, remember?
Right.
Travis Walton, the wound up waking up on the road. Well, these guys woke up on the road 200 feet from their car. Then they drove back into Tehran, and they thought it was the next day, and they had actually been gone for 2 days. So I was aware of this story, and I approached the general and started speaking to him, and then I started telling him the story, and I mentioned the Erbuz Mountains, and when I did so, I saw him react.
What was the name of the mountains?
Erbuz, Erbuz.
And where are they at?
They are north of Tehran, in Iran.
Okay, all right.
See that everybody's worried about nuking? Well,
Well, are they coming from those mountains? Is that where they've got their little bunker, you think?
In those mountains, and they're appearing in those mountains, and apparently it's a good hiding place or a good base. But the point was this. I told them the story, and then the conference came, and after the conference, I approached him again to thank him and to ask a few more questions. And then he said to me, you know, something I didn't mention during the conferences. The next day, the next morning, I got into a helicopter, and I flew a helicopter to the area where the UFO landed, trying to find traces of it. I found no traces, but I found a family who had seen it and had reported a loud noise and a bright light. But I wanted to tell you, this was in that area that you told me about in the Erbuz Mountains. So we had two events. He wasn't aware of this abduction event or the information I had, but I mentioned the Erbuz Mountains, and then he remembered. Holy mackerel! That's where I saw this aircraft.
Wow!
So we have. This is what I mean by cross-pollination of information.
Right.
How it works. The advantage of everyone to share facts, to filter them, and get to the facts themselves. And when you have one fact and you present it to someone, they give you the other fact, you have two facts and you have a clearer picture of reality. So this general, former chief of the Iranian Air Force, had not known about this incident and had not told about landing the helicopter the next morning to the general public, but because I shared that with him, he shared with me, hey, this place was the same place. These men were taken from the Airbus Mountain, and that's where I saw the craft land. So it boils down to that, you know, the sharing of true, honest information leads to greater understanding, better understanding.
It's like a bunch of little jigsaw puzzle pieces that once you start kind of throwing them in together, they start making a bit of a picture more clear.
Absolutely.
Hey, Robert, tell me about the Black Triangle.
Oh, sure. Now, the next, another very prominent military officer who appeared there was Major General Wilfred de Breyer. And Major de Breyer, then Major Colonel de Breyer, was the man who was in charge of the investigation of the Black Triangle that was seen flying over Belgium between 1989 and 1990. And he told the story of how they sent F-16s after this craft to try to intercept it, and that the craft would be hovering, and instantly it would be doing 2,000 miles an hour with G-forces.
Wow.
That would have killed any human being who was in such a craft. Now, the great thing about the Belgian Black Triangle incident is that the Belgians were ready with their cameras, and there are many, many photographs of this craft. As a matter of fact, the Black Triangle is dear to me because it was the first UFO photograph that I enhanced. When the original Black Triangle photograph came out in 1992, the Petit Rochon photograph, as they call it, because that's where it was taken.
Right.
It was very, very dark. It was practically black with four bright white lights, flaming lights, visible. So I took that and I put it in my computer and I enhanced it, and I was able to bring out the shape of the craft, plus a mysterious red orb that's flying above and behind the Black Triangle. So I've been watching this for a long, long time. I released it on the end, Dr. Bruce Cornett, but I did so anonymously because I didn't want to be openly involved with ufology. At that time, I was investigating the John F. Kennedy assassination.
Right.
And I was, like, ridicule me or try to discredit me, like, oh, yeah, forget it. You know, he believes in UFOs, so let's not believe him about JFK. So I did it anonymously. Then when I got there to meet General de Breyer, I said to him, you know, I've seen your work for a long time, and thank you for being here. And as I said, you know, I've studied the photographs. He opened it up. He opened up his folder, and there was the photograph. And I said, hey, that's my work. That was a practically totally black picture. I enhanced that and released that in 1993 on the Internet. He says, oh, I've heard of your work. Well, probably not, because I don't do these things publicly, but you've seen my work. So then we had a chat about that, and he told, it was repeated, that this incident with the Black Triangle was repeated all across Belgium and Holland. And as I said, if you go to UFO Digest, my latest article is Photo Analysis and Interpretation of the Belgian Black Triangle, because I've been tracking this triangle, not just in Belgium, but in New York State and the United States for the longest period of time. And this Black Triangle was appearing in New York State in the Hudson Valley throughout the mid-80s. It seems to have left New York and gone to Belgium, because from 1984 through 1988-89, the Black Triangle was appearing all along the Hudson River, as they call the Hudson Valley, as it goes upstate through the Catskills, and all along I-94 in Connecticut. So this thing would crisscross. It would go north and south over the Hudson Valley and the Hudson River, and then it would go east and west over Connecticut, Westchester, across New York, into New Jersey. And a lot of strange happenings, you know, missing time, abductions, many abductions throughout Westchester and the Hudson Valley during that time. If you read a book called Night Siege by Alan Hynek and Philip Imbrogno, you'll get all the details. It was really a fine book. Alan Hynek, you know, the guy who used to do the Blue Books.
Right.
Said goodbye to the Air Force.
Right.
Well, one of the most remarkable stories there is that the Black Triangle came in over the Hudson. It came across Westchester, and it hovered over Indian Point nuclear facility. And it caused quite a stir because it hung over the facility for 20 minutes. During that time, the security cameras captured the craft, but no one camera could capture the whole craft. This thing was so big, it covered up the whole nuclear facility. So we're talking about gigantic craft.
Sure.
I had the privilege of flying over that facility for many years. You know, before 9/11, the restrictions weren't as strict as they are now.
Right.
So I used to fly up the Hudson, up to Bear Mountain, to Stewart Air Force Base and so on, heading upstate. For example, I chased the eclipse of 1994, so I flew up to Saratoga because I just had to see this annular eclipse. So I got to fly over Indian Point many, many times and just by it, you know, going over the river at different times. And I'm telling you, this, for it to have covered Indian Point, this thing must have been 1,000 feet long. As a matter of fact, my youngest brother was on I-84, which is a major east-west interstate through Connecticut into New York and on into New Jersey. He pulled off the road about 4 years ago, and because he saw this black triangle flying so low that he just couldn't believe it. He says it was 1,000 feet or less. So he pulled it off the road to look at it, and he said to me, "Robert, imagine a U.S. Navy destroyer floating silently in the air, and you'll get an idea of how big this thing was."
Wow. Why do you think crafts that are observed are so interested in where we apparently have nuclear devices at?
Oh, well, obviously, they have an interest in our planet and in ourselves, in the humans, you know. I would think, well, microbiology is as good a name for it as any, and they are worried, you know, that we're going to attack. There's some great experiment that they're conducting on this planet, and the nuclear threat is a threat to that project, whatever that project is, you know, the abduction, the abduction of women and men. But, you know, they never talk about the men. Or very rarely. You hear about women being abducted. But thousands of men, dare say millions of men, have been taken. When they take the men, they try to get a sperm sample. So this thing, obviously, is a long-term genetic research program. And as we've spoken of before, I believe it goes way back into prehistory. This is not recent. What I think is recent is that the human consciousness grew expansive enough or wise enough to allow itself to perceive this phenomenon now in scientific terms. But the phenomenon has been with mankind throughout history, reflected in legends and myths and actually straight historical accounts around the world. For example, the Japanese have the longest official recorded history, and I mean official in the sense of government recording history of ufology, dating back to the 1700s. Every major change in Japanese rule was presaged or preceded by a UFO flap. There's an excellent book called The Chinese Roswell that I recommend to anyone who's interested in the history of UFOs in Asia. Bring me back to Rendlesham Forest and the guy who touched the craft.
Right.
He not only touched the craft, he saw symbols on the side of the craft, which he jotted down with a very nervous hand on note paper. And I was able to handle those. He had them at the conference, Jim Penniston.
And what did they look like?
Well, they are there's always this triangle, which seems to be the logo, you know, the V-shape or the triangle seems to be a common logo to a particular class or race of craft, if you want to call it that. The grays.
Hey, Robert, I'm trying to get a visual here when you're talking about triangle. Now, are you talking about, when you're saying triangular, are you referring to what the flying wing used to be like for the Air Force or something riding, more distinct?
Nope, riding on the craft. I'm talking like we put the star of the United States Air Force on our aircraft.
Right.
We put our logos on.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about.
I'm talking about the Belgian sighting. Was it triangular in shape, more like a boomerang look of the flying wing that the Air Force had, or is it more really like a real triangular with, you know, the 90 degree angles or 45 or whatever they are?
You might say it was like an equilateral triangle.
Okay.
Two corners of the two of the corners cut off, so it's straight. It's a flat edge. It doesn't taper up the triangle. The edges, the ends of the wings are trunked off.
Okay, got it. All right, thanks.
But if you want to see it, just go to UFODigest.com. I've collected the best photographs ever of the UFO, the Black Triangle, and I've enhanced them and I've posted it. It's a long article, a 16-page article on the the Belgian UFO.
Okay.
I want to give you a little secret.
Now, you know that nobody listens to us, so this is going to be our secret. Go ahead.
Okay. I've analyzed the photograph. I told you I've been tracking this for a long time, the photograph of the Battle of L.A., and everybody thinks that that was a flying disc. And what they're doing is they're looking at the photograph and looking at the point where all the surging on a small area of a larger craft.
Wow.
That larger craft is in there in the black background, and I've enhanced it, and it is a gigantic black triangle.
Really?
That's my interpretation of what I see in the photograph that I've enhanced. But imagine this, up there floating, like the craft that I described floating over Indian Point Nuclear Station.
Right.
This car comes up over this valley in L.A., and everyone thinks it's the Japanese, so they bring all the searchlights on. The thing is black now. They shine all the searchlights, searching the sky, and it hits something. One beam hits something.
Right.
So, but the spotlight is hitting this edge or this part of the body. The other spotlights converge, and all the light converges on this area, and a great luminosity appears and creates this ball of light reflected and refracted.
A halo effect.
But the object is so much bigger than that point where they're converging.
Right.
But it's never been seen before because it's been very, very dark. The photo is very dark, but with the modern graphics tools that we have today, you're able to basically make the sun rise on a scene by changing gamma, brightness, and contrast levels.
And do you have that posted on www.ufodigest.com?
No, that's coming soon. That's the Christmas. That's the Christmas gift. But I'm giving you fellows a preview of how long this thing is.
Very nice.
Love that.
February 25th, 1942. At least 65 years in photos, but this craft, it's this class of craft. Let me call it that, because they come in various sizes. The Belgian Triangle was kind of one of the smaller class of this class of craft. The one in L.A. was maybe 1,000 feet. More like the one that was over here, over Indian Point. It's distinct from the flying saucer craft, and may in fact be one of the carriers that deploy the smaller craft and recover them, as was seen by General Jafari over Iran. Although he couldn't see the shape of that craft because the light was so brilliant around it. He described it as a star, but much brighter than a star. He said the colors of this craft, the Iranian craft, all the colors of the rainbow were going, but they were going so fast that you could see them all at the same time, and as a result of the brilliance of it, you couldn't see the shape, which is the same testimony many other pilots have given.
I want to talk, since you're such an expert in this field, in the Shirley MacLaine interview, she had said that the one whole thing that made her a believer and got her researching all the things that she did was the saucer sighting over Washington, D.C. back in 1952, 53. She couldn't remember specifically. All right. Now, she said there are documented pictures of that that were, you know, that the government, you know, kind of faux pas at the time. But have you ever gotten a hold of any photographs of that incident in Washington, D.C.?
I've seen a lot of photographs of the purported photographs of the incident. One of them is very famous, and it shows what we'd call a fleet of UFOs behind
right.
the Capitol.
Mm-hmm. That's how she described it.
By mm-hmm. the Capitol, right.
One particular picture, I don't embrace it completely, because if you look at the full picture, the uncropped picture, in the foreground just below the Capitol is a huge number of huge street lamps, street lights, whose bulbs are clearly seen. And it seems to me that it's possible that that myriad of floodlights in front of the Capitol could be causing lens flares on that particular photo. But there are other photos that I cannot explain that way, but I'm just talking about the most famous one. There's also on the Internet, on YouTube, there's a purported film of it, but it's from a much later time. It's not supposed to be the 1952, but a much later one. That's the Robert Stanley, Washington, D.C. UFOs. Is
right.
Robert Stanley. And he concentrates subject of Washington, D.C. flaps and overflights. And he has, if you do Robert Stanley with an L-E-Y at the end, on YouTube, you'll probably see the footage. It's very interesting footage because it's color footage, and it looks like dates to about the 1960s. So I wouldn't say it's the 1952, but God only knows how many times they've overflown Washington. Very few get into the news.
Right. I have one that I want to ask you about, and then I'm going to let Dave wrap it up with his one that he wants to ask. But I'm sure that you are constantly, if not hourly, submitted with photographs and videos to look at. I know myself, I've submitted some for clarification on what they are, although I know that a couple of them have turned out to be just seagulls flying around in the fog, but we won't talk about that one. But
Iberia, that was great.
There's one that's currently floating around right now that seems to be making a little bit of a buzz that I guess it has been taken off of the Google Maps program that shows apparently a triangle that was captured, and I believe it may be even over Australia, if my memory serves me correctly.
But the Greenland one is also very interesting regarding the thing appearing from the melting snow. But the black triangle over Australia, I've seen that photograph. Hard to say whether it is a black triangle in flight or a triangular area of asphalt runways or some kind of Australian secret base.
Right.
I don't get the feeling of altitude in the photo. You know? It seems to be on the ground, so it could be a landed triangular craft, or it could be an area that's been geometrically engineered to appear as a black triangle from altitude. It makes something very easy to find, by the way, right?
Right. Since you brought it up, what is your opinion on that oblong thing that seems to be uncovered by either the snow or ice? You'd alluded to that briefly before. What are your thoughts on that?
People are trying to debunk the photo instantly because there is a large rectangular black area, let's say to the south of it, parallel to it. It's just black, so data drop. But as I look at that object or surface emerging from beneath the snows, it seems to me to be something that is precisely that, something that is emerging from beneath the snow. The color is not one solid color. It diffuses with the density of the snow above it. It disappears under it. The snow sprinkled on top, let's say, appears to be distributed in a natural manner, as it would be if it were windblown.
Right.
The edge disappears under the snow, as we would see some object disappear naturally under snow. And then what I find most interesting Everybody's looking at the object. I'm looking at the whole area. And I see a large depressions in the snow. The snow is not all flat white. It's got varying shades of white. And I discern large depressed area there, bounded by straight rectilinear ridges that are under the snow, which could be part of a much, much larger complex still buried under snow. And my first thoughts when I saw this, my God, could this be Thule or Asgard, you know, the legendary home of the Norse gods in Hyperborea? This could be something like that. God only knows. I think the only way to do to find out is to really go there and see what's on the snow, under the snow. They're really interesting.
Yeah, I do too, and I certainly hope somebody will follow through and look that up. I think Dave has one last question before we wrap things up here.
Yeah, and I do, and I'm sure you're aware of the saucer moons that were discovered by Cassini, but can you tell me a little bit about that?
Fascinating. Now, here, I told you just at the beginning of the program that we are in the midst of a paradigm shift.
Right.
Something's switched. You know, it's not all ridicule and debunking now. The media has discovered a secret. And let me be cynical. They've discovered that they can make money off UFOs. they're going to have a UFO
Spielberg,
program.
Tell me, yeah.
The money signs go up. So they're now saying, hey, man, you know, these people are interested. Let's make some bucks. So, great. Whatever the motivation, they're after it, you know. They've got the tiger by the tail. Right. Let's just hope it doesn't eat them. So paradigm shift that we've gone through.
And would you explain what paradigm shift really is for those that may not have a clue?
Well, a paradigm is a basic model, your basic design, fundamental design for anything. And, for example, Newtonian physics was the paradigm of science from the time of Newton till Einstein came. So when Einstein came and professed the relativity theory, that major paradigm shift.
Okay.
And that's what I mean by what has happened and is happening this year, that there has been a major paradigm shift, and we are in the midst of it. The public is curious. The public wants to know. The fear factor is diminishing in across the country, the world, in the willingness of people, especially the people who have remained silent or mute for so many years, the old military guys, the former intelligence officers, and so on, who are now courageous enough to speak freely about what they experienced. And the fact that the government isn't going after them for breaking their secrecy oaths.
Yeah, what's up with that, though? I mean, you know, I mean, what do you think that is? I know that's a sidebar, but what do you think that is, Robert?
There's a tacit approval saying, well, you know, it'd be worse to try to quash it now because it would draw more attention to it. I think they've resigned themselves to it. The fact is that we, the ufologists, you know, the people, the public itself, has been unraveling this mystery, and the credibility of it and the belief in it and the seriousness of it has grown, and it's reached critical mass. And they realize that the walls of secrecy and disinformation that they put up is crumbling under the onslaught of millions of people like yourselves and myself in working to get to the facts. And that's the way it is. So they have to resign themselves to it. Remember, the government works for us. We don't work for the government. If they don't do the job, we have to do it. And that's what's been happening both in the JFK assassination field and in the UFO field, which seemed to be converging very quickly. And the death of JFK can be tied into the UFO problem as well.
Yeah, and I've heard that from more than one source.
The MJ-12 documents and the Byrne memo and the significance of the Byrne memo.
Right.
Top secrecy of a conversation he had with James Webb, director of NASA, on November 12, 1963. We have to get the facts.
Right.
Why is Abe still held top secret? The conversation he had 10 days before his death with the director of NASA is still kept top secret, and neither transcript nor tape is released to the public.
Right, and I don't think it ever will, do you?
Well, we never thought the Kexburg files would be released, and Leslie Keene has won that battle. Remember, the government is not all black and white or good and evil. You know, there are really a lot of good people in every department, and the same divide that exists out here in the public between believer and non-believer exists inside the government between disclosure and non-disclosure. So we have our allies inside the government, too, you know, the good people who believe in truth, justice, and the American way.
You don't have a uniform in your closet, do you?
I have a bunch of uniforms.
That's for another show.
Well, listen, Robert, I know that we've intruded on you about as far as we can, and we can't tell you how thankful we are, Robert, to have you as a friend, and Johnny and I personally thank you. So that wraps up another interesting show with Robert Morningstar, and I'm going to wish everybody a great evening and hope you enjoyed this show. And until next time, this is Dave Rabbit.
And this is Johnny Anonymous. Thanks for joining us this time on the ATS Mix.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.AboveTopSecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. We'll be right back.